before we open the Bible together and hear from Prash, I'm going to read the Bible for us. Tonight's passage is Psalm 22, which is on page 547 of the Pew Bibles. That's Psalm 22 on page 547. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, I find no rest. Yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the one Israel praises. In you, our ancestors put their trust. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were saved. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Yet you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you even at my mother's breast. From birth I was cast on you. From my mother's womb you have been my God. Do not be far from me, for trouble is near and there is no one to help. Many bulls surround me. Strong bulls of Bashan encircle me. Roaring lions that tear their prey open their mouths wide against me. I am poured out like water and all my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted within me. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircle me. They pierce my hands and my feet. All my bones are on display. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. But you, Lord, do not be far from me. You are my strength. Come quickly to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dogs. Rescue me from the mouth of the lions. Save me from the horns of the wild oxen. I will declare your name to my people. In the assembly, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, honor him. Revere him, all you descendants of Israel. For he has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. From you comes the theme of my praise in the great assembly. Before those who fear you, I will fulfill my vows. The poor will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek the Lord will praise him. May your hearts live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him, for dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship, and all who go down to the dust will kneel before him, those who cannot keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him, future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it.
Thanks, Caitlin. Well, as we start tonight, welcome. We do a series in January working through Psalms, so this is kind of where we're up to after a few years. This is a well-known psalm, or certainly components of it are well-known, but heavy psalm. And as we started, I just want to ask you a question. I want you to ask yourself a question. You don't need to feed it back to me now. But what's the one thing you want above all other things? What's the one thing you want above all other things? Now, that could be a hard question, although you may be very processed and know the answer straight away. What's the one thing you want above all other things? In other words, I'm asking you, all that stuff you want, when you drill down, what's the key thing that you want? What's the one thing you want above all other things? Now, the Americans have this document called the Declaration of Independence, and in the preamble, you may not be familiar with it, and nor should you be, but if you're an American, you very much are, and I think most people are familiar with this part of it. It writes, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Heard that phrase? Heard that little spiel before? Among these unalienable rights, it writes, are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, if you know the context in which the document's written, the first two make sense, life and liberty. This is the time of the struggle, American Revolution. But the last one is fascinating, the pursuit of happiness. Would you have included that in your preamble if you're trying to set up the things that are the absolute right of every person? I think it's a very insightful statement, the pursuit of happiness, because I think perhaps deep down, the thing that we all really want, that one thing, is to be happy. We want to be happy. If you ask a parent, you say, "What do you want for your kid?" "I just want them to be happy," they say. And maybe if you think about yourself, you think, actually, yeah, I think that feels like a virtuous thing to want. It might not be good to want that house or that car, but to just want to be happy, well, that's okay. That passes muster, so to speak. We want to be happy. Now, Psalm 22 is kind of one person's, and look, that's that story, that journey from sadness to happiness is kind of like a life narrative, actually, for everyone. We're all on that journey in some sense. We're looking, we're trying to navigate our way through. And sometimes you have seasons within that larger story which are acute reflections of that, of a movement from deep despair to joy, or a hope that you'll move from deep despair to joy. Now, Psalm 22 really plots one person's movement from sadness to happiness. You don't need to be a psychologist. If you just reflect on the first verse and the last verse of the psalm, there's an extraordinary movement that takes place. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's quite clear that the psalmist is in a very dark place at the start of the psalm. But then you get to the end of the psalm and it finishes on this very distinct note of praise. He has done it. He has done it. And so the psalm is kind of plotting that pathway from sadness to happiness, from despair to joy. And as I said, the starting point is in the depths of forsakenness. It's not a word that we use often, but you don't really need to use it to know that it's not a very good thing at all to be forsaken. It means to be alone, to be isolated, to be separated, to be abandoned. And even there's a great insight. Often our great moments of sadness and despair are also tied with a moment of separation or a moment of isolation or aloneness. That's often the thing that makes us feel so sad. Now, that experience for the psalmist, this ultimate low point of forsakenness, is mediated in a sense, or that experience comes to him through what I'd call two voices. In verses 1 to 5, it's kind of like an internal voice. It's like a battle that's going on within him. You could almost imagine him having the conversation with himself in those first verses. Yeah, verses 1 and 2, my God, why have you forsaken me? Verse 3, yet he's the one who's rescued Israel. And he goes back and forth in those first 5 verses. And there's a real sense of struggle for the psalmist there, that internal struggle, internal experience of despair and forsakenness. And I guess, if nothing else, Psalm 22 tells you that the Bible gets that internal private despair that at times we experience. It gets it. That is actually part, it recognizes that's part of the authentic experience of people at times. That even if things look great on the outside, inside there's this ongoing tumultuous battle between even what they know objectively is true and what they experience or what they feel, so to speak. But the second voice is an external voice. Verses 6 through to 18, verses 1 to 18 is really the psalmist in this state of forsakenness and reflect on it. But verses 6 to 18 is external. In a sense, it's not just forsakenness and despair. It's not just an internal experience. It's also something that's affected by your circumstances, your place, your time, and the people, importantly, around you. Verse 6, scorned by everyone. I'm despised by people, he writes. Verse 7, they hurl insults. Verse 13, they open their mouths against me. Whoever said sticks and stones break my bones, but words never hurt me. It's just patently not true, is it? I don't know why they said it. Maybe they're raging against that very reality that actually what people say and the way people treat us really can draw us. And by the end of verse, by the end of that little section, you really get a picture of the depths of despair that the psalmist sees as they divide up my clothes. In other words, they treat me as if I am already dead. As if I am already dead. And both these voices, the internal and the external, they are really powerful. This is a true and real experience that the psalmist is going through, and it has a significant impact on him. Verse 14 says, my heart has turned to wax. It has melted within me. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd. Every part of him is impacted, weighed down, destroyed almost, certainly taken apart. It's not part of him that is untouched by the grief and the despair and the sadness of where he is. It's a profoundly intense and heavy psalm to be reading, particularly in January as we think about a year ahead. But as I said to you, there's a movement that's taking place in the psalm. There's a movement of experience. There's a movement of emotions, for want of a better word, from sadness and despair to happiness and joy. And the question that we have here is, how does that movement take place? How does that movement take place? How does the psalmist move from that place, that most abject of places, in verse 14, my heart has turned to wax, to where he finishes? This is a very important question. It's a very important question because I've been convicted the last few weeks about the centrality of joy in the Christian life. Centrality of joy in the Christian life. And even though it's so central, it seems almost out of reach at times. Sometimes for very important and serious reasons, but other times just because you haven't had enough sleep or the people you work with or just your life circumstances aren't what you want them to be. So how do we move from these places sometimes of intense despair or even if it's just apathy to joy and to happiness? How does that take place? It's a very important question for us. Now, when we seek to kind of turn things around in our life, we have a few levers that we normally pull. And I say we because there is no distinction between what happens here in the group in this building and the people outside this building. I think we all are prone to pulling these kind of levers to make ourselves feel happy, so to speak. One of the key ones is often material things. It's work, it's a job. It could be as simple as just the latest gizmo that you buy. I remember when I was 18, I had a relationship go south and I felt really devastated. And so I went to JB Hi-Fi and I bought myself a CD. And it sounds stupid, right? It sounds trivial. And of course it is. But I felt pretty good for a while until she walked back into the cafe and then I felt bad again. But that's the experience, isn't it? Like we drug ourselves with something. And that's a trivial example, but look, just think about it. When you think about your priorities and where your energy is being poured out at the moment, is there a tendency sometimes to think, well, if I just sort out the career thing, if I just have that new phone, if I'm just dressed the right way, I'm going to be happier. If I just look the right way, I'm going to be happier. There's always that tendency. And it's not just material things. One of the other levers we pull are relational things. We really do believe that if we get our relationships right, we'll be happy. It's funny when you talk to someone who thinks that a friend of theirs is going to marry the wrong person, right? What do they say? They say, oh, I just want them to be happy. I just want them to be happy. We think that relationships somehow are the lever that we can pull for that. But of course, even that doesn't always work. One of the other levers we pull is a sense of autonomy. We think, if I can just wrestle back control of my life, then I'll be happy. I mean, maybe that's why we chase that material thing. Maybe that's why we chase that relationship. We think, if I can just take control, then I will be happy. That's the word of our age, really. If I just am free to do X, Y, or Z, then I'll be happy. But of course, the problem with all of these things is they don't work. I mean, they might work for immediate gratification, but they eventually turn around and show you their weakness. If it's something you buy, if it's a person you invest in, if it's just yourself and your own personal autonomy, in the end, they are just not sufficient to give us the happiness that we long for. There's a 2013 Deakin University study which said that young and rich people are seeking help for anxiety and depression at twice the rate of their poorer peers. At twice the rate. That doesn't make sense, does it? I mean, we think, well, hang on, if they have more money and they have more autonomy, shouldn't they be happier? They get to choose what they want to do more readily. But that's not how life bears itself out. In fact, one of the researchers says the old adage that money doesn't buy you happiness is true. Who would have thought? In fact, it might even buy you a few problems there. So it just doesn't work. Those levers that we go to make that transition, to make that movement, to move ourselves from a season or even a whole life orientation to despair, to joy and happiness, those levers, they don't work. And if you're someone who has been kidding yourself that that job that's just killing you but providing you with an extraordinary income is somehow going to give you the kind of happiness that ultimately we're all seeking, I want you just to take that moment and give yourself a truth bomb. That is not going to happen. It's not going to happen. What's really interesting about the psalm, though, is that the psalmist doesn't go to those things. They're not the things that move him from where he starts to where he finishes. And here's the key truth. Here's the key truth for Psalm 22. If you're looking for nothing else, it's this: that sadness and joy are found in relation to God. In fact, the foundation of all our experience, good and bad, is the state of our relationship with God. That's the psalmist's point. The foundation for all. In fact, he says, my God, that's the most commendable thing about the opening verses, that even in his despair, it's in relation to God. My God, why have you forsaken me? In verse 15, he says, you lay me in the dust of death. Those two verses are so difficult. They're actually really difficult verses because he's attributing to God. This is scripture. He's attributing to God a role in his suffering and in his despair. And there's just enough to be said for sermon upon sermon on those. But I just want to draw this key point of Psalm 22 to you, that to understand joy, to understand despair, it is always in relation to God, always in relation to God. And you see this really bear out in the structure of the psalm itself. Verses 19 to 21 are kind of the pivot verses of the psalm. The whole psalm's kind of like a prayer, I guess, but 19 to 21 really is a prayer, a direct address to God. And those verses actually are where everything turns around in the psalm. And what we see is that the psalmist prays in a very extraordinary way. He prays expectantly. He prays believingly. Actually, verse 21 is an interesting verse. Whenever you translate from old, you know, Hebrew to English, or even Greek to English, Old Testament's written in Hebrew, right? Whenever you translate from that, there's always kind of, there's gaps, just like any language. You still get the point, but there's little nuances that sometimes missed. And so the NIV kind of paints it like he's praying for salvation. But the ESV is a bit more helpful on this one. There's another version, English version. It says, from the horns of oxen, you have rescued me. In a sense, the psalmist, by the time he gets to the end of that little prayer in verses 19 through to 21, he's not just hoping, he's in a sense almost receiving the answer to his prayer. He's asking, he's expecting, he's receiving. And the point, again, as I said, is that in the midst of his experience, turning to God is what changes it. That's where deliverance comes from. Verse 25 emphasizes that the movement from despair to joy, from sadness to happiness, comes in an encounter with God. Comes in an encounter with God. Now think about all the levers that you're pulling to make that movement happen. And the question I have to ask you again is, do any of them reflect that profound truth? An encounter with God. But it must be said that the psalm is not primarily, even I don't think, a personal prayer, although of course it starts as that, and when it was first written, perhaps the psalmist thought it was exactly that. But over the fullness of time, what we come to see is that the psalm is also a word of prophecy. Like I said to you, you've probably read parts of this psalm before, particularly I suspect many people have read the first verse of this psalm. And the reason is because these words are attributed to Jesus himself when he is hanging on the cross in the Gospels. In Matthew and Mark's Gospels, Matthew 27, Mark 15, Jesus cries out those very words at the start of Psalm 22. Now, he probably said a lot of things. In fact, he did say a lot of things in those last moments on the cross, because the gospel writers include other things that he said as well. John, for example, says, Jesus said, "It is finished." But for Matthew and for Mark, they include this particular thing that he said. Why is that? Well, in part, when you cite the first line of a psalm, it's a bit like citing a footnote, you know. Go and read the psalm, in other words, because he's not, even though he doesn't cite all 31 verses of Psalm 22, by using the first lines, he's drawing on, he's saying, the words of Psalm 22 are my words at this point. They are my experience. And, of course, there are all these hints through the psalm about dividing up clothes, which draw us back to that moment of Jesus hanging on the cross. But the question, of course, is why? Why would Jesus cite Psalm 22? What, just kind of to say he's having a really bad day? This is the depths of his despair? Well, yes, but I think it's more than that. I think because at the heart of God's whole mission is this movement from sadness to happiness. The way you could describe God's whole work is to move people from despair to joy. That's the trajectory of everything that he's longing to do. And the pivotal moment in his whole story, in his whole mission, is Jesus Christ hanging on the cross. And so when he's crying out that, he is saying, hey, guess what? I am the place where it changes. I am the place. I am the encounter. I am the one who will transform your despair to joy. And what's more, I will do it by being forsaken instead. I will do it by being forsaken instead. Those words, I'm not just using them to describe my existential crisis. Jesus is just using them to describe his spiritual reality, because he's truly forsaken. Your apparent experience of forsakenness is nothing like his real and true and deep and disastrous experience of forsakenness. And that's the pivot. That's the key encounter. That's the thing that changes. That's the thing that moves you from sadness to happiness, from despair to joy. That's the thing that activates God's great plan and his great work and his great longing in your life. That's the great thing. And so that's ultimately, fundamentally, the key to happiness. That's the key. Now, there's still more to be said, though. What does it then look like to have happiness shaped and introduced by this key, profound moment? What does it look like to have that kind of happiness? I remember a VeggieTales episode. Some people are laughing because they may have taught it in Sunday school, or they may have seen it themselves, actually. VeggieTales is, if you've not seen it, it's a cartoon that they use to teach kids Bible stories and lessons, like Christmas, for example. There's a VeggieTales Christmas episode. And they're called VeggieTales because they're vegetables dressed up as people. I'm not sure as much to ask Ali Collins why that works, but nonetheless, in this is a Christmas episode, and it starts on a fairly sad note. Little Nick has jumped on a boat. Little Nick's also a vegetable. Just assume they're all vegetables, okay? Little Nick has jumped on a boat to explore the world and kind of come to understand what life and meaning is, because his generous, Jesus-loving parents have tragically died. It's a really heavy place to start for a kid's story. Now, towards the end of his journey, he stumbles into this church and he sees this woman, vegetable, but woman, who's feeding the poor, also vegetables, but the poor nonetheless. And what she's doing is really familiar to little Nick, because that's what his parents did. And what's more, her demeanour, her whole character is very compelling to him because she looks joyful in doing what she's doing. He looks joyful and he thinks, aha, I have found the answer to happiness. If I just do what she's doing, which is what my parents were doing, then I will be happy. So he musters up his courage and he goes up to her and he asks her this big question. He says, Miss, does this make you happy? And she replies with something like, oh, honey, this doesn't make me happy. I get to do this because God has made me happy. And there's such a profound truth there. It's a profound truth. What's trying to say is that the happiness of people impacted by the gospel is just very different to that kind of passing transitory joy that other people have. Here are three little implications of having gospel-shaped, God-given happiness. First of all, happiness is not something you pursue, but it's rather, especially if it's happiness that has the gospel at the centre of it, happiness is something that's given to you by God. It's given to you by God. You don't have to achieve it to receive it, so to speak. It's something that God gives to you. And actually, that's a really great thing. Because if you suddenly don't have to work the right way or meet the right people then to be happy, then you can let go of some of the anxiety that's often tied up with trying to be happy. It's something that's given to you. But secondly, happiness, which has the gospel at its heart, is happiness that's found more in the promises of God than even in the immediate circumstances. If you look at the psalm, the last four verses, 27 through to 31, there's one word that repeats over and over. It seems innocuous until you reflect on it. It's the word will. And here is the high point of the psalmist's great praise and joy, right? And the word that he keeps repeating is will. God will do these things. And his joy, you see, this is a great lesson for us. His joy, his contentment, his happiness, so to speak, comes in light of the promises that God has given him. Not in the circumstances. I mean, his circumstances probably haven't changed. It's only 31 verses, and it took Caitlin about 3 minutes to read it. So either his circumstances were not as bad as he said in verses 1 to 18, or they haven't changed. But something has, which is that he has grasped hold of the promises of God in that space of time. And he has grasped hold of a lasting and real joy. That's wonderful. But secondly, and this is perhaps the thing that the VeggieTales account is really driving home for us, is that happiness does actually shape your activity now. We should actually be joyful people. But you don't just pursue something because it will make you happy. You pursue something because you already are happy. You pursue something because you already are joyful. And that is just essential to the Christian life, that truth. This week is, you know, summer club. It's about evangelism. Some of the things are just going to be fun to do. Like making the kids laugh and doing craft with them is not hard. But having an evangelistic conversation with someone, that's harder. In fact, that could be uncomfortable, especially if it's a parent who doesn't end up wanting to have that conversation with you. But God is asking us to do hard things all the time. Things that will not always give us an immediate experience of joy. We will have to give things up. This year, we hope to challenge you week in, week out to do the hard things for God. But we want you to be joyful. The only way you'll do hard things for God and be joyful nonetheless, if it's a joy that God has given you, which you do not have to earn. So my prayer for this week is that for those involved in the work of the gospel through the week, that you would find great joy in that, even when it's hard. But I think that's a larger prayer for us this year, that we will be joyous people who willingly do what's hard anyway. Because the joy we have is not, it's not contingent on our immediate experience. It's something that God has given us at great cost to himself. Amen.